Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be your chair for today. It is now my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Marvin Olasky has had an interesting religious journey. He was born in 1950 to second-generation Russian immigrant Jewish parents, and like his parents and his brother, he developed his early religious ideas from the study of the Torah. As a teenager, he grew increasingly skeptical of religion, and he became an atheist. According to Mr. Olasky, and I do quote, "I was bar mitzvahed at the age of 13. I became an atheist at the age of 14. After college, he joined the Communist Party, and in 1976, he was baptized and became an evangelical Christian, who even helped found his own faction of the Presbyterian Church in Austin, Texas. Marvin Olasky is known to many as the godfather of compassionate conservatism. In 1989, while on leave from his job teaching communications at the University of Texas, he discovered what would become the cornerstone of his political philosophy. And this philosophy was put forth in a 1992 book entitled The Tragedy of American Compassion, one of many nonfiction books that he's authored. This book caught the attention of several conservative thinkers, including former Secretary of Education William Bennett and the Republican Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Subsequently, Governor George W. Bush of Texas adopted many of these conservative philosophies as part of his mantra. The president's faith-based charitable initiatives were born from many of the ideas in that book. Marvin Olasky is currently a professor at the University of Texas at Austin and is editor-in-chief of World, America's premier news magazine from a Christian perspective. And as I said, he has authored many books, including Prodigal Press, Abortion Rights, The American Leadership Tradition, and The Religions Next Door. And his book, The Tragedy of American Compassion, was reported by Philanthropy Magazine as one of eight books that changed America. President George W. Bush wrote the foreword to Dr. Olasky's book, Compassionate Conservatism, and called him Compassionate Conservatism's leading thinker. Today, Marvin Olasky will discuss government's failure in its response to Hurricane Katrina, an account he has written in his new book, The Politics of Disaster. Let's give a very warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Dr. Marvin Olasky.
Well, thank you, Joe, for those kind words. I'll be noting today some ways that government officials failed. So let me start with a Texas story about how officials do offer help. It starts with a mom on a farm looking out the window. She sees the family cow eating grass and her daughter talking with a strange man. The mom furiously yells out the window, "Haven't I told you not to talk to strangers? You come in this house right now." And the girl offers a protest. "But mama, this man says he's a United States senator." And the wise mother responds, "Well, in that case, bring the cow in with you." Well, yeah, I'd like to talk with you about responses to disaster. Since I've told you a Texas story, I'll tell you another one with a San Francisco address. It concerns the great earthquake 100 years ago that you may have heard about. The charitable outpouring then was immense. People in 1906 gave what they were able from their own specialties. The example, the New England Shoe Association contributed boots and shoes to those whose footwear was ruined by cinders from the big fires that followed the earthquake. The Women's Christian Temperance Union of Brawley, California, sent 464 loaves of bread, 42 biscuits, and one sack of donuts. I wonder if the recipients fought over the donuts. Prescott, Arizona, sent 80 head of cattle. The mining town of Cripple Creek, Colorado, sent gold that would be worth probably $250,000 today. A debutante sold her trousseau and contributed the money, saying, "These fine things mock me." And personal help also was very common. Volunteer doctors and nurses flowed into San Francisco as the newly homeless flowed out. Portland took in 3,500 evacuees. They received meals, baths, clothing, lodges, and employment. San Jose volunteered to take San Francisco's prisoners because the destroyed city no longer had a functioning jail. And it just went on. You can see the response of city after city. And then some big givers came through. Railroad companies donated railroad cars and tracks. The Southern Pacific alone handled for free 1,409 freight cars of supplies, the equivalent of a train 10 miles long. And those who had lots of money often wrote out big checks. John D. Rockefeller, Jay Gould, Andrew Carnegie gave $100,000 each, which is the equivalent of maybe $6 million today. Now, let's turn to last year's Katrina disaster and a concept developed here in San Francisco that explains well what happened. You may be aware of the book published this year, The Long Tail. It's been a bestseller. It shows how businesses often look for the few products that will sell an enormous number of units, but there's gold to be prospected among the many that sell few. Examples, over 1 million tracks on iTunes sell at least once. Over 95% of Netflix 55,000 DVDs rent at least once per quarter. And it seems that 98% of Amazon.com's top 100,000 sell at least once per quarter, and so on. And all these small sales add up. That's the way it also works in disaster relief, in rescue, recovery, all the aspects of dealing with a tragedy, a disaster such as Katrina. Contrary to popular emphasis on FEMA, help after disaster always has had and continue to have last year a very small head and a very long tail. And various units of government are at the head, but then come thousands of small religious and civic groups. Now, I'll be talking about what some churches and other religious organizations did following Katrina and are ready to do following whatever the next disaster is. But I want to emphasize that this is not just a Christian thing. There were synagogues in Florida, for example, that were very helpful after the hurricanes 2 years ago. And there are other parts of the tale that provide extraordinary help. I'll give you one example. A fellow named Malik Rahim, an ex-Black Panther in New Orleans, decided after Katrina, during and after Katrina, to set up an informal health clinic at his local mosque. And he soon was joined by some community health folks from the East Coast led by a lesbian anarchist. She and they came with a truckload of medicines. They talked their way past military checkpoints. They linked up with Rahim. They put tarps on the floor of the mosque. They set out their supplies. They spray-painted a sign on the mosque's external wall, first aid. And people who needed tetanus shots or other basic medical help started coming. There was one soldier who dropped by to check out the clinic and talk with the volunteers, and they told him of their backgrounds. He wasn't sure that he'd heard straight, so he asked, "Okay, you are the anarchist in the mosque brought in by the ex-Black Panther giving free health care?" And they explained yes. And he replied, "Cool, that's great." And it was cool, and it was great. So the tale after Katrina was made up of all sorts of folks. Given the religious composition of the U.S., and especially the Southeast, most of them were Christians. Some of the bigger organizations quantified their help. 9,000 Southern Baptists from 41 states volunteered 120,000 days, during which they served 10 million meals and pushed forward cleanup and recovery efforts. During those same 2 months, the Salvation Army served nearly 5 million hot meals and over 6.5 million sandwiches, snacks, and drinks. And much more cumulatively was done by all the church groups that made up the tale. And as Joe mentioned, I edit a weekly news magazine, World, so we had reporters in, over there in lots of cities and towns in southern Louisiana and Mississippi, and they regularly heard words like these from Ronnie Harris, who's the mayor of Gretna. Quote, "Church workers were the first volunteers on the ground. It is churches that made the difference in Hurricane Katrina recovery," end quote. And our reporters also heard praise for companies such as the dreaded Walmart that got supplies to people. Sheriff Harry Lee talked about conditions in his Jefferson Parish, which is just outside of New Orleans. He said, quote, "FEMA executives were there, but they didn't do anything. They weren't up and running for 4 or 5 days. If the federal government would have responded as quickly as Walmart, we could have saved more lives," end quote. And Lee said that FEMA actually made things worse rather than better when Walmart sent 3 trailer trucks with water to a FEMA compound. FEMA officials said they needed written authorization to accept such supplies, and they didn't have any. So Walmart ended up distributing the water directly. This is the way things often worked. You hear about needing written authorization to accept supplies. It seems silly in some ways, but that's an example of the system of government by paperocracy that we've developed over the years. And every level of government, local, state, federal, practices paperocracy, often out of fear of litigation. I'll give four quick examples. First, Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans did not emphasize 2 days before Katrina struck the imperative of evacuation because he was afraid that hospitals and restaurants would sue him for loss of business. When Katrina did hit, and on that first day, folks were asking their mayor about the action he was taking, he said, "Yeah, I'm taking action. I'm making a list of needs to send to FEMA." So paperocracy. Second example, there were some 400 doctors, nurses, other first responders who assembled in Nashville to head into New Orleans. And then FEMA gave them something to do. They had to fill out 60-page applications that demanded photographs and tax forms and so forth so that FEMA would authorize them to get in there. Paperocracy. Third example, FEMA diverted to Atlanta. Lots of volunteer firemen, search and rescue pros, paramedics, so they could sit through seminars on diversity and sexual harassment. You know, these seminars are often a good thing, but FEMA officials there were worried more about lawsuits or something else happening than about getting help to people who really needed it desperately. They worried about the lawsuits. They told the volunteers then that their only job would be to hand out flyers carrying FEMA's toll-free number. Again, these are firemen. These are search and rescue pros, and they were told, you know, just hand out flyers, our toll-free number. Paperocracy. Fourth example from Louisiana Congressman Bobby Jindal. He tells a story about a mayor who called state and federal officials for help and, quote, was put on hold for 45 minutes. Eventually, a bureaucrat promised to write a memo to a supervisor. A sheriff from my district office reported being told that he would not get the resources his office needed to do its job unless he emailed a request. And, of course, the parish was flooded and without electricity. End quote. Paperocracy. I could easily tell 400 such stories, perhaps even 4,000. Government officials often were not part of the solution. They became part of the problem, and this is all levels of government. FEMA head Michael Brown, the famous Brownie, told emergency responders to stay home unless they had a specific request from governmental authorities. Louisiana Governor Blanco wanted the state government to run the water rescue operations, but providentially there was a Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Jimmy Duckworth, who had a different opinion. He made it known. He thought rescuers should go out with anything that could float. And the Coast Guard did. I mean, they, in fact, were the one governmental institution that worked well in those first several days. But there were a lot more things going on. There were perhaps 25,000 people rescued by anything that could float. Folks in New Orleans and surrounding communities went out with canoes, skiffs, kayaks, rowboats, anything that would float. They didn't wait for authorization. They didn't ask for permission. They just went. They didn't pay attention to what Governor Blanco or FEMA said. They were part of the long tail, and they saved thousands of lives. I can't resist one other San Francisco reference. This is the 35th anniversary of the famous or infamous movie Dirty Harry. Some of you will recall the film starred Clint Eastwood as a San Francisco cop who was hated by the liberal mayor, but he's called upon when the going gets rough. And in the movie, the Eastwood character gains his name, his nickname, because he takes on the most difficult tasks the city can offer. He says to his partner once after heroically saving a person from death, "Now you know why they call me Dirty Harry. Every dirty job that comes along." And there are advertising posters around the country 35 years ago for Dirty Harry proclaiming, concerning again this main character played by Clint Eastwood, "You don't assign him to murder cases. You just turn him loose." Well, after Katrina, there were thousands of Dirty Harrys who emerged. And these heroes and heroines just wanted to be turned loose. I mentioned earlier the, quote, lesbian anarchist, end quote, who talked away past guards and made it into New Orleans with medical supplies. So did two guys in a church van. Those doctors and nurses who had to fill out those 60-page forms in Nashville wanted to bring with them bandages and splints and medicine. And FEMA insisted, "Well, you're transporting these items across state lines. You need 2 state permits." And so the church van just smuggled in the supplies. Now, you might think at this point I'm about to, or I have been, blasting the government. Not exactly. Criticism, yes. Maybe even sarcasm at times when I can't resist it. But let me say this. We often complain about government moving with the speed of a brontosaurus, but we would also not like it to be reacting like a raptor, tearing at the flesh of anything in its way. Government gets criticism when it's slow or when it passes out money like crazy without checks and balances. It also gets criticism when it doesn't get money quickly to people who need it. So what do you do? I mean, do we have any other choice but desperately try to improve government at all levels? Well, sure, we want to do that, but is that our only option? Do we want another reorganization of FEMA? There have been lots of reorganizations. And in the press over the past week, there's a debate going on inside the Beltway about the more reorganization. Do we need more plans? I mean, there was a 400-plus page plan that I've read through for New Orleans disaster relief. But what happens when you have a disaster, it's kind of like when you have a major battle. There's the what people call the fog of war. There's the fog of a disaster. You can have all the plans you want with, let's say, people precisely going up and down every street or alley to rescue people, and it's not going to work when communications are down, as communications eventually do go down in disasters. It's actually more effective to have the long tail in operation and have volunteers going up and around and talking to each other. Well, I found someone over there, and there was another person waving from that house that I couldn't get to, so go over there, and so forth. That, ineffective though it seems in some ways, that's actually the most effective thing when you rely on individual and group initiative. That can often work much better than a master plan that looks nice on paper but does not work in reality. And so you do hear pundits calling for reorganization of this and more of that and so forth, but there's another way, and we're just at the beginning of seeing how far we can push it. Volunteers rescued many folks from the roofs of their houses. Volunteers also gave some Katrina evacuees new roofs over their heads. Let me just read you two of my favorite offers of housing posted on the internet, some on Craigslist, some on other things that developed during the first week after Katrina hit. I mean, here's one offer. I just love the writing on this. We are a family of five. We have a very small room with a bed and two small dressers that we will offer to you so that you can get back on your feet. You'll be welcome at our family table. We don't have much money after the bills are paid, but we'll happily share whatever we can. We don't expect you to pay us, and we won't expect you to leave quickly. It takes time to rebuild, and we'll give you that time. End quote. Here's another note. Quote, I am a black single mom and can house another black single mom and 1 to 2 children under 2 for free for 3 months. I've been on welfare. I've put myself through school, and no way have I been through what you have been through, but I can try to help you navigate confusing systems. Just be respectful of the resources that I can provide. No smoking, no drugs, no profanity, also limited or no TV. I can help you make it. Now, did some of those offers of help evaporate once the emotions of the moment subsided? I suspect so, but many came through. Many came through in San Francisco 100 years ago and New Orleans last year. The aftermaths of the terrible earthquake and the terrible hurricane both demonstrated the importance of compassionate conservatism, by which I mean not just a governmental activity or sending a check to a charity, but person-to-person help, often but not always performed by volunteers, often but not always coming from a religious base. I'm a senior fellow at the Acton Institute, based in Michigan, and it has a Center for Effective Compassion. And that's a useful term to keep in mind, effective compassion, not just feeling sorry for someone, not just emoting, but actually helping a person to get on his or her feet again, perhaps to change a life. And we've seen over the years, in disasters and other situations, that effective compassion rarely emerges from governmental offices. Compassion means with passion. The root of the word passion is pati, to suffer. So compassion means suffering with those in need, being intimately involved with their problems. That's what makes compassion effective compassion. It's far more than sympathy. Those people who offered a room in their homes were willing to suffer with those in need. I mean, that's the basic ingredient for effective compassion, offering challenging, personal, and often spiritual help. Now, is there no role for the federal government in disasters? No, there is. And I go back to the preamble to the Constitution, which speaks of the federal responsibility to, quote, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, end quote. Provide and promote. They are two distinctly different verbs. One means do it yourself. The other means help others to do it. Promote means to create an infrastructure that enables compassionate people to offer their services. When disaster comes, the federal government can do what it has done at times, sometimes not as quickly as it should. It can try to recreate law and order. It can try to keep the roads clear. That is, if the state and local forces are overwhelmed, then the federal government should be there for those basic infrastructure needs. Law and order, keeping the roads clear. The reports of violence in New Orleans, which often were tremendously exaggerated, delayed rescue of people at the Superdome or the Convention Center by probably a day. I mean, some infrastructure problems were real, and the feds would have done much better really working on those than instead coming up with grandiose plans. There's a financial side to promoting the general welfare. Officials in the 18th century sometimes paid out-of-pocket costs of citizens who housed or fed victims of emergencies. They saw such payments not as compromising the volunteer spirit, but as allowing poor along with rich families to offer help. And we can do the same by providing tax credits, which would be applicable to Social Security as well as income taxes, to all individuals who take evacuees into their homes for extended periods. Right now we have tax deductions for financial contributions, but no tax recognition of the far greater commitment that sharing a home represents. So we could make it financially possible for that black single mom I quoted, as well as all kinds of other individuals, poor individuals, middle-class individuals, we can make it financially possible for them to help evacuees over a long period of time. Right now, some can. Others, more could, if, in fact, we thought seriously about here's a way to help to house people. We could do lots of other things to promote the general welfare. Given the record, the successful record in disasters of many charities and the failure of FEMA, why not try to deal with this problem by not just funneling more money to FEMA? Why try to do it that way? That's our instinctive reaction. Yes, we have to have more of a federal governmental presence, but that's the head. The long tail actually can do much better. And why not create incentives to contribute more to voluntary organizations so they could cover their out-of-pocket costs during relief operations? You know, conservatives tend to lambaste the French these days, but the government of France, trying to awaken charitable impulses there isn't as much charity there as in the United States. The government of France has just enacted a tax credit of 66% of the value of a donation to churches, schools, and some other charities, up to a maximum of 20% of a donor's taxable income. And we could do the same. I mean, some have even proposed, and I've been one of them, proposed a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for contributions to anti-poverty and disaster-fighting organizations. I mean, let me just ask all of you here in, you know, a liberal city, I mean, how many of you, given a choice between sending $500 to FEMA or $500 to some other group that could help when an earthquake hits in San Francisco, I mean, how many of you would send the money to FEMA? I don't see any hands raised. I mean, how many of you know of some other organization that you think would do a better job than FEMA? I see some hands going up. So, yeah, I mean, this is a very simple idea, but a $500 tax credit. $500 less going to the federal government, $500 more going, I suspect, in most cases, to local charities that we know or have seen can do a much more effective job. I could talk more about what charities and other organizations do, have done, could do in disaster situations, but I do want to allow plenty of time for questions because I see you're all writing those questions and Joe's collecting them. That's great. So let me end with a Texas story that concerns the importance of planning ahead when a disaster looms. And this story is about an old man dying in his upstairs bedroom. And he smells his favorite smell in the whole world, freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. He summons up all his remaining strength. He makes his way down the stairs. He reaches his withering hand towards this heavenly sight, platter upon platter of chocolate chip cookies. And splat, it's a spatula slapping his hand. It's his wife, who's holding the spatula, and she says very fiercely, "Stay out of those cookies, they're for the funeral." Well, I hope that disaster-related funerals in this city are a long way off. I hope that all of you take actions to minimize the number. And that reminds me of one thing that I would be remiss not to mention on this lovely day. We should thank God for his mercy. With everything that can go wrong in the world, with hurricanes each year filling many of the letters of the alphabet, with earthquakes a possibility, it's worth noting how much goes right. And why should we assume good weather and good health? Why not be thankful for a sunny day like today and many other days as well? Anyway, thank you all for welcoming me, and I'll be glad to answer your questions.
Our thanks to Marvin Olasky for his comments here today. We have many questions, Dr. Olasky. I have put them into several different categories, and maybe if I were to think of two categories that the questions fall into, one would be your theme of compassionate conservatism and try to expand a lot on that. And secondly, there's quite a few questions here on many of your personal views on many conservative issues. I'd like to start with a question that you almost ended your prepared remarks on, which is that Christianity today seems more focused on personal salvation, on one's comforts, their wants, and their needs, than in helping those less fortunate. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you may find that in some churches, but you'll find lots of others that look at both, that look at personal and societal needs. Just a couple of examples. Again, I work with the Acton Institute in Michigan. We've just had a Samaritan Award contest where groups could try to win a $10,000 first prize, and then help in other ways. Others could get help with their needs to improve. Hundreds of entries. I think there are about 900 different organizations in the database, and most of them are Christian, are church groups, other religious groups. And these are groups that are societally working hard to help, as the Bible talks about, the least among us. These groups are working to help poor people, homeless individuals, unborn children. And you see this all over the country. I mean, I've visited over 100 such groups over the years in various states. So a lot of this is going on. And you may hear, if you go into one church, you may hear just a sermon about personal salvation. I don't tend to minimize that. That's important. But you go into another church, you may also hear a sermon about how we need to be loving our neighbors as ourselves. And, one example. I visited last year a church in Leesburg, Florida, which is about a mile's drive northwest of Orlando. And here's a church that right on the church property, there are, along with a big steeple, there are seven other buildings right there by the church. One's for homeless men, one's for homeless women, one's for children who need emergency foster care, one's a medical clinic that serves lots and lots of people. And again, these are not just for church members, this is for the whole community. A clothing place, a food place, all these types of things are right there on the church grounds. So, here's a church where they preach about individual salvation, but they also preach about reaching out into the community, and they more than preach about it, they show it. And when Katrina hit, they welcomed 10 refugee families or evacuee families from Katrina, gave them apartments, cars, helped them get jobs, and this is what they do all the time, and there are hundreds of churches like that all around the country.
We have several questions that ask pretty much the same question. This one, I think, says it best. Why is person-to-person help compassionate conservatism? Couldn't you just call it compassion? What makes it conservative?
Well, when I started researching the history of poverty fighting in America, this goes back to the late 80s, I did see a difference between the predominant use of compassion in the press and the way that I was starting to learn was actually a more effective understanding of compassion. The way I primarily saw compassion defined in the press was governmental, that if you voted for a multi-billion-dollar spending bill, purportedly that would help the poor, then you were compassionate. If you voted against it, you lacked compassion. And these were basically bills introduced and voted for by liberals, and bills promoted in a press that's largely liberal. There have been some changes over the years since then. And so it seemed logical to refer to that type of compassion as liberal compassion. And then I started to try to find out historically what's the alternative. What do you find out when you go back and you see the very effective compassion that people offering challenging and personal and spiritual help provided? And that seemed in contrast to the understanding of vote for a bill, you're compassionate, vote against it, you lack compassion. If you would call that liberal compassion, then this other type of thing called compassionate conservatism.
What are some of the major misconceptions about compassionate conservatism?
One right now that's become dominant in the past year is that compassionate conservatism means governmental spending. And the way that compassionate conservatives can achieve goals is to work through Washington. Now, as I mentioned here, there are things the federal government can do to promote the general welfare. And that may include providing incentives for people to contribute their time, their lives, their homes to people in need. Again, that's promoting. But because Congress, the Republican Congress in recent years has been on a spending spree, there's a tendency to associate compassionate conservatism with that, with in a sense big government conservatism. I've seen articles in many conservative publications that are lambasting compassionate conservatism at this time because they feel cheated. They feel it's actually a euphemism for more government. And that's not the way it was originally developed or intended. The idea was to try to see what volunteers and people in the community could do and to push that along as much as possible, perhaps with tax incentives, but not to just have a bigger federal government apparatus. So that's the misconception from the conservative side. On the liberal side, there's the conception it's just all talk. It's a politically useful phrase for Republicans. And, all I can say to that, now this is the 45th anniversary this year of President John F. Kennedy's famous speech in Berlin, where he talked about individuals who said that the West could in no way survive in this struggle with communism. And in response to that, and this is a time, of course, where there was the Berlin Wall, and that was the center of the conflict in many ways, he said, let them come to Berlin. And he was pointing out that here's one example of people very bravely standing up against forces of evil in the world. For people on the liberal side who think this is all political euphemism and nice vote-grabbing technique, those folks should go to Leesburg, Florida, or Clio, Michigan, or right here across the bay in Richmond. There's a homeless shelter that's doing great work, and we just profiled that in World. So just get out. That's what I would say to people with misconceptions. Just get out and look around and see what people are doing out of a desire to do for others in some ways what Christ has done for them.
Thank you. In preparing for today's program, I was very interested, as I discussed with you just a few minutes ago privately, about your own path, your journey, as I called it in the introduction, your own path from Judaism then to atheism and Christianity. So I feel that I'm way ahead of the curve here and from our discussion and from my own reading, but I think this would be a good baseline briefly to talk about that because, as I indicated, there are questions about many of your personal views, and I think it's important to know how you got from A to B to C.
Right. Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to be concise. Grew up in Judaism, going to synagogue. I mean, went to Hebrew school for 6 years. I mean, Hebrew school in the afternoon after public school classes. Learned a certain amount of Torah, which is getting into Talmud, because I actually went for another year to a Hebrew high school. I really enjoyed that at the time and valued it at the time. But as Joe mentioned, and this is a sad thing in large parts of American culture, Bar Mitzvah 13, atheist at 14. My brother is 3 years older than me, and I think he introduced me to books that just swept me away. Two in particular, and again, I think he may have introduced them, I may have gotten them in some other way, but one, H.G. Wells, The History of the World, and he's well known, of course, for science fiction, but he also wrote a very readable history that's straight materialism. You know, all the stuff about God, I mean, this is stuff for children. Hey, we're grown up now. Let's read the real stuff. It's all material. All things happen for given billions of years and lots of chance occurrences. That's how we are where we are. So that had enormous appeal to me, especially the idea of grow up, don't believe in these childhood fables. And then the other book I was reading as an early teenager, I read Sigmund Freud's The Future of an Illusion, where he talks about, this belief in God is just We have hopes of our Father on earth, and if he disappoints us in some ways, if we're looking for perfection, then we take those ideas and transfer them to a Father in heaven. So it's sort of a wish fulfillment projection type thing. So H.G. Wells and Freud, I mean, really convinced me. And there was other stuff too, but I became, in my own wisdom, as I supposed it was, an atheist. Started going to Yale University in 1968, and of course this was the Vietnam War era, and I got involved in lots of demonstrations and kept moving further and further to the left. Marxist, became a member of the Communist Party in 1972. The first time I came to San Francisco, actually, I was selling People's World, the weekly newspaper of the Communist Party, in front of the Emporium. So that's where I was some, 34 years ago. I think, as I recall, that I was a happy communist. I mean, this was a religion for many people, including myself. But late in 1973, I started to wonder, well, is the atheism, which is the base of my communism, actually accurate? And there was just one particular time in November of 1973 that I started to believe that there was a God of some kind, and I didn't know what kind. And then several things happened, not things I was particularly looking for, but just a couple of them. I was studying Russian in order to, which I'd originally started studying in order to speak to my Soviet big brothers. But when I came to believe in God of some kind at the end of 1973, I resigned from the Communist Party because I knew, as Lenin had written, that communism is based on atheism. And the atheism was no longer there. But I didn't really know what I was, theologically or politically or anything. And I just concentrated really on writing my papers for graduate school and doing the research and so forth. But I had to have a good reading knowledge of Russian. My Russian wasn't very good. I looked through my bookcase one night just to find something to read in Russian, something, anything. And it turned out there was a copy of the New Testament in Russian there, which I had been given a couple of years before. There's a long story, which I won't go into, of how I had it, but I just hadn't thrown it away. It's kind of a novelty item. And so I started reading it, and reading very, very slowly. And I'd read the New Testament before, I mean, just to see what Christians believe. Read it very quickly and sort of scoffed at it. But here I had to read very, very slowly, puzzle out the words, think about it a lot, and it started making enormous sense to me. And I started thinking, this is not just something from man, this is something from God. So that got me thinking about things, but still I didn't act in any way. I was busy just, you know, doing research, writing papers. I was assigned the following year to teach a course in early American literature. What's early American literature? It's Puritan sermons. These dead white males from 300 plus years ago were, in a sense, preaching to me. And I think I had grown up thinking that Christianity was a religion for soft-headed people. You know, maybe kind, maybe nasty, but not very smart, not bright. People perhaps who worship Christmas trees or something like that. And here, I mean, these Puritan writers, such as Jonathan Edwards, who was often called both by religious people and secular people the greatest philosopher America has ever produced, I couldn't say they were stupid. In fact, they were very bright, and they made great sense. They logically connected things, so it wasn't just an emotional leap. There was thinking behind it. So those types of things had an influence on me, and slowly, basically fighting it all along the way, and perhaps at the end of the process, reading some Francis Schaeffer. If any of you have read, he's a theologian who died about 20 years ago, but very good books. Reading some C.S. Lewis, realizing, well, this is true. And even though, boy, I certainly don't want to join, you know, a church. And I still had all these prejudices against churches, and I don't want to be involved in that. Still, you know, truth is truth, and I came to the conclusion this was true, and that's a conclusion that in the 30 years. Since then, has only deepened in my understanding. So that's my own path. I know other people have other paths, and we just have to see what God does.
Well, that's a very good backdrop. And as a follow-up, I'd like to ask a question about your views on abortion. Could you please explain your viewpoints on abortion? Do you have an opinion on the California proposition that is coming up concerning the mandate for minors to receive parental consent? What should be the role of government in these issues?
Well, I haven't looked at all into the specific California situation and so forth. But as far as minors needing parental permission, sure. I mean, minors need parental permission to get their ears pierced in most states. Again, I don't know the particular California law, but that's typical. I mean, minors need parental permission for any kind of medical thing, any kind of surgical thing. In this situation, unless we think that perhaps a 14-year-old has all the wisdom that's required to make a decision like this, then sure, you want to have parental involvement. I mean, that seems almost... unless I wrote a book on the history of abortion in America called Abortion Rights, R-I-T-E-S, unless you make it a right, R-I-T-E, of a church, in fact, that almost seems like, sure, of course you want to get parents involved in this, unless you see it as a particular, almost a religious ritual. Now, you know, there are some situations, there are, at least from my own research, they're not that frequent, but there are some situations where the girl would be in physical danger from parents in a situation like that, and then you have to have protection. And that's why, and I don't know whether this particular ballot measure has it, you sometimes, in very rare situations, and the language has to be very careful, you can put in a judicial bypass. So in situations where it's very clear that it would be unsafe for the girl and perhaps also unsafe for the unborn child, then you don't have to go to the parents. You can have a judge in that situation. So I'd have to look at the wording of it. But in general, sure, this is much more serious than getting ears pierced or 100 other things. I mean, whether you're for abortion or for choice on abortion or against it, at least I think it's generally recognized now, as it wasn't always in 1970. It's generally recognized that this is a very, very serious business. There is another life involved, and 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds are not necessarily in the best position to be the sole judges of that.
Thank you for that answer. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program with author and godfather of compassionate conservatism, Dr. Marvin Olasky. For more information on this or other programs, please go to commonwealthclub.org. Another follow-up, Dr. Olasky, a question on immigration and the Minutemen. This person would like to ask you about the Minutemen, who patrol our border with Mexico as vigilantes with no official authority. Is this private sector assistance gone wrong, or should communities be able to respond in this way?
There's a wonderful book that I would commend to all of you by Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, called Mexifornia, if I remember. Is that right? Yeah. And I think it's a wonderful book because he doesn't look at the problem of illegal immigration primarily as a law and order problem or a dollars and cents problem. He starts out looking at it as a problem involving compassion, and that you know appeals to me. I mean, here you have millions of people in the United States who have no legal protection. Because they can be preyed upon, P-R-E-Y-E-D, they can be preyed upon by business owners who might cheat them, by people who might beat them up, by all sorts of things, because they don't have, there isn't law and order for them. They can't really go to the authorities. So it's a bad situation, and Hanson gives examples of exactly how that works out in practice and how difficult it is. So what I think you want to do is find a way to regularize the status of people who are already here and plan to stay, and this is why there are bills that make sense to me to work towards guest worker programs for people who are here but really have family back in Mexico and want to go back, or ways for the people who are already here to move over a considerable period of time to legal status, and in the meantime to gain protection, so that they don't have to run from the law, and in fact if someone treats them unfairly, they do have some legal recourse. Now, I think that's only going to work, both politically and culturally, if at this point we gain control of the border. So, you know, I was in Israel and went over into the Palestinian area back in March, and so I actually looked at their border fence. And most of it, I mean, there are parts in urban areas, it's a very ugly wall. Most parts, it's a fence with electronic surveillance stuff. I don't really want to hold that out, because I don't hold it out politically as the solution for Israel. But it did seem that here's something you can actually do in terms of border security. You can have a fence of that sort with electronic sensors around so they are able to patrol the border. And if we can't do that, I don't see how, at least politically, we're going to be able to move towards what I think is the major objective, to regularize the status of people who are here. So I think you have, I mean, my sense is, and I'm no expert on this, but you know, we've sent reporters there, and so I've talked with them about this, I mean, to border areas. And I live in Texas, so I hear about this also. And we have lots of, you know, lots of illegal immigrants going to church. So I want them to have some protection. At the same time, we have to control our borders. So I think you need the combination. It's a Texas two-step, in a sense. You need a border wall or fence, and you need to do something to regularize the status of people here and have them go through a process of applying for citizenship, if indeed it's their goal. And then I suppose the third thing, so I'll make it a California three-step, is some sort of a guest worker program.
Well, you've opened up our minds to the Middle East, and there are a few questions on the Middle East, and I certainly don't tend to dwell on that, but this question reads as follows. Although rallying faith-based charities to replace our welfare state, thereby possibly reducing the cost of welfare programs and saving taxes, occurs under your thesis, isn't there a greater danger in destroying secularism in America? After all, Hamas and Hezbollah are faith-based groups calling for the destruction of Israel and the United States.
Yeah.
Do you see a similarity here?
Well, I mean, I do see that the expression faith-based group is a euphemism that's developed, a political euphemism, and it's sometimes erroneous or inadequate. Not all faith-based groups are the same. The Muslim who helped the people in New Orleans getting tetanus shots and other first aid was doing great work. And there are many Muslims who do that. I mean, there are also many Muslims who do terrible work. And, you know, we've just had our 50th anniversary of 9/11. I think we have to keep both in mind. So, I mean, there's a civil war going on right now within Islam, in a sense. Who's going to take the lead in this huge, you know, 1.3 million member religion? Is it going to be towards war, jihadic war, or is it going to be towards peace? And hard to know how it's going to turn out, but you know, I don't support the faith-based groups that, in their faith, do suicide bombings and or homicidal bombings. I mean, I also don't support Christians who go out and assassinate abortionists. That's not the way to proceed. So not every faith-based sensibility we have is to be applauded.
Well, I would wager that your relationship with President Bush is much stronger than anyone's in this room. And there's a question here, several questions actually, about the current administration. President Bush said that no one could have predicted that the levees in New Orleans would break. However, several months after the disaster, a video was leaked that showed that President Bush was being clearly briefed about potential levee breaches. And this was by Mr. Chertoff and Mr. Brown, known as Brownie. And this is before the hurricane hit, of course. Could you please comment on the video and whether you have knowledge about this?
Yeah, I haven't seen that video, but I read about it. And there may be some technical aspects involving, you know, breaching or overtopping or stuff like that. You know, what exactly is the definition of a breach? But that's playing with language. I mean, clearly the levees failed. And clearly there were warnings well before that. That this was a problem and this could happen, and you're supposed to do something. So what happened after Katrina is that President Bush was very slow in responding in the way, for example, that Bill Clinton had responded. I mean, Bill Clinton, you know, I'm critical of him in a lot of ways, but one thing he did very well was showing people he cared. After Oklahoma City bombing, after other things. And you go back away. I mean, the previous Texas president, Lyndon Johnson, when there's a hurricane, I mean, he's famous for, at night, going to the people who were evacuated or in trouble in some way and shining a flashlight up in his face so people could see him and saying, you know, I'm your president and I'm here to support you and so forth. I mean, this emotionally was a good thing, just to show a sense of suffering with. President Bush didn't do that, and got lambasted for flying over and looking out from high up from out of his airplane window and so forth, rather than getting down there quickly on ground level. Then he overreacted, in my view, verbally, trying to show how much he cared after he was getting these attacks in his press, and he started making all kinds of promises, all kinds of statements, and some of which I suspect were factually inaccurate. So, this is the normal process of government. First, it goes one way, maybe doing too little, other times doing too much. Then it goes to the other extreme. It goes back and forth. It's very hard to find the right path. And here, when people are challenged, sometimes they say things that they, if they had been better informed or more thoughtful about it, they wouldn't have said.
I have a question, two questions actually. I'd like to combine, if I may. This questioner states, "I've heard a theory that the rise of public assistance in the 1930s led to the decline in private sector giving." And then the second part would be that Americans are generally considered as charitable people. Is there a difference between the giving habits of religious and secular people?
Yeah, to answer the second question first, there is. There have been some studies showing that number one, there is a big difference of religious and secular people as far as giving, that on the average, people who go to church once a week or more are twice as likely to give and give twice as much. And you can actually track it out in a lot of ways. So there have been a lot of studies showing there really is a difference. And there's even a difference among different types of religious organizations. That I saw one study that people who go to evangelical churches tend to give more as a percentage of their income than people who go to more theologically liberal churches. So there are those studies, and again, these are broad studies. This doesn't necessarily mean that in every case this is going to happen, or that people of one particular sector are inevitably less generous than others. As far as the question concerning the 1930s, I've gone back in that period, and it seems to me that people in the Roosevelt administration had to make a choice. There were organizations, religious groups that had been the primary charity deliverers in America up until that time that were really stressed enormously as the income of the people who contributed to them went down and their contributions went down at the same time that the needs went up. So one thing that could have happened, and there were people talking about it at the time, but not that many, one thing that could have happened would be an attempt by the federal government to strengthen those organizations, to try to work through them, to acknowledge that actually they had been very effective in normal times. Here was an abnormal situation, and is there a way you could help them to do a job with all the stresses they faced at that point? That wasn't the way that the Roosevelt administration chose. They chose, in essence, to put up a parallel structure, to put up a parallel governmental structure that would be helping people directly. And there were a lot of reasons why they did that we could explore, but it seems to me to have been historically a mistake, because the same amount of money would have been much more effective if it had been used through the organizations that had already proven their effectiveness over the years and, in a sense, were just topped out. You could almost look at it, I suppose, like here you had levies that were being breached or topped, the levies of charity for people in need. And the government at that point in 1933 decided, instead of trying to strengthen those levies, build a whole different system of levies and let those increasingly be knocked down or fall apart as the federal government took more and more resources.
Recent Commonwealth Club guest Professor Randall Balmer of Columbia University stated in his remarks here that evangelicals have lost their way since their women's rights and aid to the less fortunate philosophies of the 19th century. Would you comment on that, please?
Yeah, small world in the issue of world that's out to our, well, I guess 130,000 subscribers now. We have an interview with Randall Balmer. Even though I don't agree with him about lots of things politically, I thought this is a viewpoint that people should hear. Let me get again his particular question or the comment.
Professor Ballmer stated that in the 19th century, evangelicals were committed to women's rights and aid to the less fortunate, and he feels that they've lost their way currently.
Well, evangelicals certainly were committed to the less fortunate. I think some evangelicals have lost their way now, but others, as I mentioned earlier, haven't. As far as women's rights, a lot of Christian groups were committed to that. A lot of Christian groups are committed to that now. Depends in some way on how you define women's rights. The leading feminists of the 19th century, for example, were strongly pro-life, strongly opposed to abortion. They saw that as man's oppression of women. And there's a group now, Feminists for Life, that's very active. So if you define women's rights as, for example, the liberty to sometimes, with great pain, with great hardship, but still the liberty to kill the baby in your womb rather than carrying the baby to term and then perhaps having a family that can help that baby, adopt that baby, then a lot of church groups now have turned against women's rights, but it's defined in a very strange way that would be totally alien to the feminist pioneers of the 19th century.
President Bill Clinton signed a bipartisan welfare reform act in, I believe, 1996.
Right.
This permitted religious organizations to apply for federal money to operate social welfare programs. Was this a big victory for compassionate conservatives?
Well, the welfare reform overall was a big victory for compassionate conservatism because it was understanding that compassion actually means suffering with a person and trying to help that person change a life, not just enabling that person to stay in poverty. So that was a big victory. I think up until then, our tendency was to treat homeless people, let's say, and poor people generally almost as pets. I mean, the way I treat my two dogs at home. I mean, you know, we put some food in their bowl in the morning and so forth, and don't expect much more from them. They're pets. Until welfare reform, very often, poor people were treated the same way. So that changed. That was a tremendous victory. The what's called charitable choice, the provision in the legislation, did not change things a whole lot in and of itself because it basically said that, well, maybe you can have Christian in your name, or maybe you can have a crucifix on the wall or something like that, but there are big differences in the way that Christian anti-poverty programs and secular anti-poverty programs tend to work. The secular ones tend to assume, much like H.G. Wells' materialism would assume, that the major problem is material. And it is. It's a huge problem, but there's also a spiritual problem also. And the Christian charities that are effective here are ones that deal with both the material and the spiritual problems. And the 1996 legislation by itself really didn't do much to enable people who supported those groups to do more.
Dr. Olasky, how do you answer the critics of conservatives who are accused of trying to take advantage of the availability of Katrina relief funds to advance their agenda? For example, implementing school vouchers and a move to privatize education.
Well, yeah, school vouchers is a good example. Their agenda, as if this is something that, let's say, supporters of educational choice want to impose on people and maybe trick them into doing it. Their agenda, I mean, it's the agenda for all these kids, for hundreds of thousands of kids who are now trapped in bad schools and don't have any choice. My sense is that parents of poor kids should have choice in the education of their kids the same way that parents of rich kids have. There's no reason that everyone should be forced to go to one school. Parents should have some choice. That's educational choice. Their agenda, I mean, it's an agenda that's good for kids.
Well, I certainly wish we had more time to expand the discussion on private versus public education, but we're at the point in our program where we've got time for just one last question, and it has to do with elections. So the question is, will the federal government's poor response, by your own admission, to Katrina hurt the Republican Party's results in the upcoming congressional elections?
I think it may. There's certainly a residue there. But I suspect come November, the biggest issue is going to be national security. And it'll be voters who have to decide whether the Republicans or Democrats are better able to deal with that. That, I think, will overwhelm everything else at that point. But the residue is there, the damage is done, and Republicans just have to deal with it.
Our thanks to Dr. Marvin Olasky, professor at the University of Texas in Austin, Texas, and editor of World Magazine and author of The Politics of Disaster, Katrina, Big Government, and a New Strategy for Future Crisis. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.